VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us today, it is The Times' very own Tom Roddy. Coming up, we'll discuss Newcastle's strike force and Manuel Pellegrini's crucial clash with Chelsea. First, though, we're looking back at this week's Champions League action. England's finest were in European action this week. On Wednesday, Chelsea and Liverpool only managed draws with Valencia and Napoli, meaning it is all to play for on game week 6. Chelsea host Lille, knowing 3 points will be enough to take them to the knockout stages, whereas Liverpool have a tough task away at Salzburg. You would imagine, Tom, that both Jurgen Klopp and Frank Lampard would have wanted their Champions League campaigns in terms of qualification to have all been wrapped up by now.
Yeah, well, Jurgen Klopp said that himself, didn't he? He said, we never do it the easy way at Liverpool. but of course, it's the issue is, you know, we've got the game coming up, the Carabao Cup game, and then the Club Championship game. It's an extremely busy month for them, December. And I think the biggest sort of concern I'd have taken away from it was seeing Fabinho walk away from that game and in the protected boot. I mean, a year ago there was talk of him possibly even leaving, and now he's indispensable to that team, I think, anyway, the way he kind of anchored in that midfield. And I think I saw them play at Palace last weekend, and he's just an integral part of that team, especially, you know, what they've been doing recently is grinding out wins. They haven't been particularly brilliant, and going through these games, that's what you've got to do in December, and I think he'll be crucial to that.
Yeah, very busy fixture list for Liverpool in December. When you have to add in all the extra competitions that they have to contend with next month, Gregor, talking about Chelsea, though, they have this one more game to come in the Champions League, and they know that a win will be enough to take them through to knockout stages. Do you think Frank Lampard might relish that? The fact, actually, they still have something to play for. It's a positive to take through into that, rather than we can take our foot off the gas, we're already through to the knockout stages.
No, I think he'd like to have been through. It is very different to Liverpool. I mean, Liverpool are the holders. They had an opportunity on their home patch to kind of see it through. Chelsea were a kind of unknown quantity in the Champions League this year. A lot of players had never played in the competition. And they've done excellently. They've done really well on the whole. The only thing, I mean, it's just been, there've been some crazy games they've been involved in. You know, after the Ajax 4-all game, this was another one. There were kind of no control about Chelsea's play at all, especially towards the end. And Valencia really could have won it, actually. Still kind of a bit of space in midfield, I think, with Jorginho and Kante playing a little bit more advanced. They're still not really got that kind of control, I think. They've not quite got that under control. And I think Reece James, as much of a kind of outstanding talent as he is, played very much kind of gung-ho, and he's a little bit naive at times, but a heck of a talent. So, you know, Chelsea, that's been part of the thing that has been so endearing about watching Chelsea this season. They've been fantastic to watch, thrilling to watch, but in the Champions League, it's just been the wacky races every week with them, and, you know, it doesn't fill your confidence for the game against Lille as well.
They reflect what they are, an inexperienced side that kind of just been put together in essence. And the issue, like you say, Gregor, about the kind of lack of control that they have in games and the almost lack of maturity, is that's where you get punished in the knockout stages. you know, they won't go far if they keep playing in that way. It was a completely chaotic game at the Mestalla last night. I think Lampard's trying to rotate the team by bringing in Christensen, who's a player who plays off confidence. And when he's not in the team, he's not confident at all. Under the Conte era, he was so much better playing in a back three. But when he's not in the team, he lacks confidence. And I think Lampard's trying to freshen it up. But there lacks a bit of maturity in there.
Heading to Austria isn't a given win for Liverpool, who were pegged back to 3-3 with Salzburg in October before Mo Salah's second half winner. Salzburg still have a lot to play for in this group stage of the Champions League. The last thing Liverpool will want, Gregor, having already mentioned the fact that they are the Champions League winners, is to be playing Europa League football.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think they'd rather just go out completely than descending to the Europa League and play more games on Thursday evenings and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, I think that was the first of 12 games in 36 days that Liverpool have. It's a crazy list of fixtures. I think you could see how much Trent Alexander-Arnold means to Liverpool. Just that one change, it seems strange. A right back is kind of, in any other team, that's, you know, he's a playmaker. And his omission was kind of, that was keenly felt. That's why they threw him on towards the end, I think. And obviously they're going to Austria, and they've got to contend with kind of one of the most informed strikers in Europe at the moment, in Erling Haaland, who's got 27 goals in 19 games, I believe. So yeah, it's not going to be an easy one. But look, I think if you go back to this time last year, that when Napoli came to Anfield, and they had to get that point as well. I remember Alisson making a worldie of a save at the end as well to sort of ensure that they progress. So Liverpool have been in this position before. In fact, they're almost always in this position. They never make it easy for themselves, as Tom said. So I'd still back them to come through.
And you mentioned, obviously, they don't make it easy for themselves. Defensively, they're not making it easy for themselves, Tom, because I think, in their last 11 games, they have conceded at least once. I think you have to go back to that sort of record of Brad Friedel being in goal for them to have conceded that many times in games consecutively. So we've spoken a lot about Liverpool's defence this season and it not necessarily looking its sharpest, but this is going to be a big concern for Jurgen Klopp, isn't it?
Absolutely. And as Gregor said, I'm so intrigued to see Virgil van Dijk up against Haaland. I think that's going to be one of the biggest tests he's had. And you see, van Dijk's still that imperious defender that he was last year. I wonder whether it's... I always look at Liverpool's midfield and question whether it doesn't look like a conventional midfield. It never has done. It works in a different way. They work in that collective, which is what Klopp always talks about. And of course, in defence, the wing backs, their kind of role is attacking football. But they seem to be caught out a little bit. Zaha did it last week, got in there behind there quite a few times. So did Andros Townsend. And that's the way Haaland plays as well. He's not your conventional number nine. He's all over the place. So you can see him troubling them.
I think you have to say Napoli, they played really well. And, they came with a game plan. They sat in deep and they played on the break. And, you know, there was an issue with Liverpool's sort of playing a higher line than previous seasons earlier in the season. And that seemed to have dissipated a bit. But certainly for the Napoli goal, they were very high up the pitch. There was talk of whether there was a foul on Van Dijk. Even as a defender, I think that would have been harsh personally. I think Napoli were really intelligent in the way they approached the game, and they've done that consistently. I think they've played three or four times against Liverpool in the last two seasons. So, I think some teams in the Premier League can perhaps take a leaf out of their book the way they approached that game.
And credit to Napoli in this as well, in the sense of they've got this battle with the owner that they're facing in Italy, who's sending out fines left, right and centre, punishing the team for some of their misconduct, let's just call it that, by not turning up at training camps that he's ordered them to be at. Let's move on to some more positive news, shall we? On Tuesday night for English sides, Manchester City and Jose Mourinho's new Tottenham team booked their place in the knockout stages of the Champions League, and it was a dramatic European entrance for Jose. His side were 2-0 down to Olympiacos before a second half turnaround saw Spurs win 4-2. So Mourinho has made his mark on North London. His first game at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, ending with 3 points. It was the new Spurs manager's biggest ever European comeback. What would he have learned, do you think, about his new side, Tom, after that impressive comeback?
That he needs Christian Eriksen.
Oh, really?
And can't rely on ball boys to...
Great quick thinking, though.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. No, I actually thought the ball boy story was great, and you always love them when they come up. They're just so sort of endearing. And but I just...
Unless Eden Hazard's kicking one.
Yes, exactly. But I just thought it kind of got lost what an impact Christian Eriksen had coming on. I thought a lot of Tony Cascarino was writing in our paper today about how, you know, Mourinho's quick changes, and it's right, he did it within half an hour, which a lot of managers wouldn't be brave enough to do, but Dier wasn't doing the job, and I didn't think he was particularly impressive at West Ham either. So I think part of this is a message to Eriksen. He said it already in his short time as Tottenham manager, that the situation, his uncertain future at the club because he hasn't signed a new contract, will dictate how he selects his first 11. And so far, that's seen Christian Eriksen start from the bench. But I can't see it going on, carrying on that way.
See, I think a bit much was made about Mourinho's influence in this game. They were 2-0 down.
Right.
And he took off a defensive midfielder for an attacking player. It's not like rocket science. And he could have taken off Winks as well, who was horrendous in the first half.
Well, he did say it was one or the other, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, Spurs were terrible in the first half. And they didn't improve much, actually, until they were gifted a goal. And then in the second half, they upped it a little bit. And still, I wouldn't say until the hour mark. Dele Alli as well, he got a standing ovation. He was terrible for an hour. They were really poor, I thought, Spurs. And yes, they showed character, but they were gifted a goal to score half-time, and they've always got Harry Kane. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had to rely upon him again. So I don't think you can make too much of the Mourinho effect yet. We're two games in. Sorry to be the miserable Scotsman.
You really are, aren't you? Everyone's like lauding the fact that everything has changed.
Getting carried away.
And maybe under Maurizio Pochettino, they might have got back into it, but it would have been a draw. It wouldn't have been anything more than a draw. That's what Tottenham used to do, wasn't it? Spursy, you know. Okay, so you're not having it. Does that mean then you're not having it that they have qualified for the knockout stages, that this could be a cup that he could win, Mourinho, for Tottenham?
I think it's a stretch. I mean, yeah, they've still got the defensive sort of frailties. Ben Davis is out injured for a bit now. Danny Rose has looked a bit rusty, I think. Another thing is, you know, people are saying that Aurier has been sort of transformed. No, he's pushed him high because he can attack, and he's a little bit of a liability defending. So, you know, perhaps that's tactical, but he's also playing to the player's strength, which is intelligent in itself. But and I think, as I say, I thought Dier and Winks were really, really poor. And Ndombele coming back is going to be big. And I think Sissoko is probably going to have quite a big part to play.
He seems like a Mourinho player, yeah. Sissoko, doesn't he?
I wouldn't even, you know, he wouldn't even go beyond Wanyama coming back into the fold, you know? I think he's going to look for strength in front of that back four, because Dier looked like he was lumbering around. I know he needs games to be kind of at full fitness, and as I say, Winks was kind of he's not quite got the defensive nous, I think, for a Mourinho midfielder. So look, they've got Harry Kane, he'll score the goals, he's continued to do it, and his record in Champions League, I think he was the quickest to get to 20 goals of any player in the Champions League, so they'll always have a chance. But I think it'll be a stretch to say that they're contenders to win it.
At the moment, I think Mourinho's just trying to push the right buttons with the players, isn't he? Even with Lucas Moura. Lucas Moura said the other night that he basically suggested that Mauricio Pochettino was wasting him by playing him as a number nine. He said, "I'm not a number nine, I'm a wide player." And Mourinho does that, and he's instantly in his good books. But on the suggestion also of whether they could win the trophy, Pochettino always described it as a miracle, didn't he? He said it would be a miracle to do that. And while Mourinho's been very kind of flattering towards his predecessor and even inviting him to Spurs Lodge for a bit of dinner, he has...
He's always welcome,
yes,
he says.
Yes, always
his home.
Welcome, yes. He did say that it's not quite a miracle. I think he was playing that down. So, yeah.
Just a line on what you were saying about Christian Eriksen, of course, not starting this game. Toby Alderweireld did start. We know that he has contract issues at the club, that he's running that contract down. But he has, after that game against Olympiacos, spoken a bit more positively of life at Tottenham. And maybe, and this is just me surmising, that maybe there will be contract negotiations on the table where he might decide to stay. Do you think with Eriksen being on the bench suggests that actually there probably is no hope for him sticking around?
Yeah, I think it's sort of heading that way. I get, as you say, you know, at the beginning, Mourinho goes in there first day. He has all these one-on-one meetings with the players, with all the high-profile players in his team. And Eriksen is one of them. He sits him down and has a conversation with him. And the outcome of that is he starts on the bench. So his indication of his future is not bright at the club. He clearly isn't keen, and that was why Pochettino had such an issue with him being there.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now let's look ahead to this weekend's domestic action. First up, this Premier League weekend, Newcastle welcome the champions Manchester City to St James's Park. A daunting prospect at the best of times, made worse by the Magpies' faltering forwards. Monday's defeat to Aston Villa was Steve Bruce's first game on the touchline at Villa Park since he was sacked by the club just over a year ago when they were in the Championship. An unhappy return that was rubbed in Bruce's face by the Villa faithful. The Northern Sports correspondent for The Times, Martin Hardy, witnessed that 2-0 defeat for Newcastle at Villa and wrote a punchy piece in Monday's paper about the hard work that the Newcastle manager has ahead of him. And Martin joins us now on the Game podcast. Despite the great amount of negativity around Bruce's appointment, Martin, Newcastle, I suppose, have started the season fairly positively. A win would have taken them into the top half of the table. Despite that defeat, they have 15 points and sit in 14th place. Is that good enough for Newcastle as things stand?
Well, you try to give anything a Newcastle United context and it's not easy. In 2018-19 season, at this stage, they had 13 points and were 12th. And the season before, they were 13th with 14 points. It suggests not that much is changing. However, when Steve Bruce arrived in what was unquestionably a storm during the summer, he was the unlikely replacement for Rafa Benitez. I think if you'd offered him and the club the position that the club is in right now, I think they would have snapped your hands off. The big problem, and with the club, there is always, everything's always countered with paradoxes. He was brought in to increase the amount of goals the team scored and to add flair and excitement, when Newcastle are the second lowest scorers in the division. So yes, it's okay. It's not bad. It's probably better than a lot of people would have thought. However, it's not quite there yet. And that was borne out on Monday night, where it was a particularly frustrating night for the three forwards. Whether Newcastle's recruitment is oversimplistic in that they were very solid with Benitez and we'll spend £80 million on Almiron, Jolinton and Alan Saint-Maximin, and the team will end score goals, might be being borne out at the minute, which is why, aside from the fact Steve Bruce had lost at the ground where he had a cabbage thrown at him the last time he was there, he really did stomp off down the touchline to get away. And there is There is, despite the fact they're in a good position, there is a lot of thought and perhaps tinkering with the team to be done.
Mm. You mentioned then that the misfiring forward line that they have with Almiron, Joe Linton and Saint-Maximin as well. What does he need to do to get them firing?
I know Steve quite well. If I could answer that, I suspect he would take me out for a rather nice meal and a nice bottle of wine.
Indeed.
And that would probably be the first person I would tell. I think realistically, and Almiron did very well when he came in last season, and I used the phrase sliding doors in the piece I did for Monday. In his debut game against Huddersfield, he tips the keeper and the ball hits the post and bounces away. And if that goes in, does he have a different career at Newcastle? He has still yet to score. Mm. He does add something to the team in terms of his energy and his speed. However, on Monday night, twice the ball was past him in the Aston Villa penalty area, and he just looked absolutely lost in terms of confidence. My thoughts would be, give him a break. It's Manchester City on Saturday. Sometimes a little break from the team can really boost the players. A lot amongst the supporters. He may come on later and get a great reception. He is still fairly popular with the fans, but I think it's a game where you think, right, come away for 90 minutes or 60 minutes, take a break, and perhaps add the energy of a Matty Longstaff in there, which was one of the things Newcastle missed on Monday, and is one of the things which is why Steve Bruce has looked at Granit Xhaka to try and add a bit more creativity and strength in the middle of midfield.
Are they starting to... Go on, Martin.
Sorry, no, I was going to say, as for the other two, it's difficult. I was never a massive fan of the idea of signing Andy Carroll in the summer. He's probably played in total about 1.5 games for all the minutes he's come on. So you've brought in a rookie from Germany in Joe Linton who has no real backup. Dwight Gayle is now fit. By the end of the game at Villa Park, you had Joe Linton had gone off. Andy Carroll was up front with Dwight Gayle, and you're thinking, I'm not sure if there's a great deal of progress in there, but we'll see.
You mentioned, you know, Steve Bruce. What's the mood like around him now? Because obviously when he got the appointment, it perhaps wasn't the most positive of reactions that was received by a lot of Newcastle fans.
Yeah, I think there's sometimes a beauty in understatement. So that's correct what you said. He knew he was walking into a very difficult situation, and he knew he wasn't he wasn't Rafa Benitez for starters, and he wasn't perhaps the big name that had been mentioned as a potential successor. In himself, you can see that his body language has softened. His shoulders have dropped, if you like. He's more comfortable chatting to everybody now. The back-to-back wins Newcastle recorded at West Ham and at Bournemouth were vital just to get the team up the table and to take the pressure off him. The next big stage is, though, to evolve this team into something different, which is why, sorry to go back to the piece I did, he doesn't want to play three centre-halves and he's inherited six central defenders. He wants more energy in midfield, which means Newcastle have to go back in the transfer market. He will unquestionably want a centre-forward that will score goals. The three players you mentioned before for the entirety of the season have scored once. So, again, come back to what I came on at. There doesn't appear to be that much progress in terms of league position and points, but you're going to have to dismantle it again to move it on. Now, there will be some money to be spent, but them three forwards he has to make work because of the way the club is run, and that's the big pressure on him. But as a person, he spent a bit of time back at home. He's more relaxed. Him and his wife, Jan, went over to the Walker Dome where he grew up, and she ran, and he said it was very emotional to go back to a place from 40 years ago where... And he's now the manager of Newcastle United. So the other thing is, he said, I will enjoy this. I don't think he enjoyed a great deal at the start, but he is starting to enjoy it a little bit.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about the piece that you've done on Saint-Maximin then. You've interviewed him, haven't you?
Yes. He did a Q&A with supporters for Radio Newcastle at the end of last week, and I was kindly invited along. Surprised. You see him on the pitch. He has the flamboyance. He has the hair. He wears the Gucci headband. But when he was there, his two little daughters were there who were fairly adorable and very cute. His partner was there. And he was a contradiction to what you expect. Now, he said, I'm very humble. He's unhappy with the perception of that he's flash in France. He wants to make things work in Newcastle. But there is just a phenomenal amount of pressure on him. But he said, I feel nothing on the pitch, which might mean that it will work. You have to remember, he's still only 22. And now all of Newcastle's attack and fulcrum comes through him. But quite a very strange in a good way, in that he was not who I thought he would be. And it seems remarkably dedicated to making success happen at Newcastle for however long he is at the club.
Martin, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate that.
You're very welcome. Pleasure.
Well, you can read that interview that Martin Hardy has done with Alan Saint-Maximin on the website later on this evening. Let me speak to you once again, Gregor and Tom, on Newcastle. Tom, what do you think Newcastle's realistic targets should be this season?
Well, I think the ambitions should be, I suppose, trying to get up to mid-table, really. Mm. That should be the goal. You've got to get as high as you can. I don't know if that's possible with that attack. I mean, Martin was talking about the Andy Carroll signing there. I think it was possibly, you know, he knows Steve Bruce more than I do, but I felt like that was more kind of honing in on the culture and community element, harking back to better days. And
it's a bit sentimental.
Exactly that. And it kind of hasn't really worked so far because of the typical Andy Carroll problems in match fitness. I mean, it'd be good to see him start a game and play the whole thing out, because he's an issue for defenders, isn't he? He's a real problem for defenders to handle. He's a handful. And Joelinton just hasn't been doing it, even though there have been early signs there. But I think the ambitions really would be mid-table.
And we've talked about, we spoke with Martin there about the issues they have up front, and they're not firing at all, the front three. But also, really, throughout the team, there are issues. There's a vulnerability at the back as well for Newcastle, Gregor. It's just a whole long list of things that Steve Bruce has to work on.
Yeah, but I mean, he knew this when he was arriving. I think they have got the kind of the basis of a sound defence. They've got some decent defenders with Premier League experience there, and Bruce can organise them well. He's done it in several games this season, notably Tottenham away. And I think Saint-Maximin's got something. I watch him and I think I would hate to play against him, because
really?
He doesn't.
So what is it you see in him?
He doesn't know what he's doing. So how are you supposed to know what he's doing? I think he just plays so off the cuff. He's like one of these guys who's playing in the playground, and he's got kind of that unpredictability, and he's got pace. So I think he could come good out of the three of them. He could be one. Whether he's going to be a prolific goal scorer, I'm not sure, but I think he could be kind of a provider. Almiron, he's the same. He doesn't know what he's doing, but there's not really as much end product. I'm not sure he's good enough, to be honest. That's the cold, kind of hard fact about him. And Joe Ellington's playing. It's a difficult team for a striker to be playing at the moment. I also think getting the best out of Shelvey is key, because when you see him, you know, he came back into the team and he's playing those passes like a quarterback, sending it from deep midfield out to the wings, and he is a real talent, you know. He's someone who's got the talent to be good enough for England, but he's just kind of had certain issues in his career and in his private life sometimes as well. So I think he's someone that'd be really important for Newcastle as well. I think they're definitely good enough to stay up, but I don't think they've got much in the way of ambitions beyond that, and there's lots of reasons for that.
Things are looking no more positive for Manuel Pellegrini and his West Ham side. The Hammers will face their fierce London rivals for a second week in a row. This time they're going to take on Chelsea, who will be looking to bounce straight back after defeat to Manchester City last week. Even with a defeat, West Ham should avoid dropping into the relegation zone thanks to their superior goal difference. But this was supposed to be the season that the Hammers left their mark on the Premier League and challenged at the top end. So why are things not working out that way, Tom?
Well, I think I think mainly, you know, you look back at the beginning of the season and we were looking at the contenders who could kind of break into that top six when all the teams, you know, to the Tottenhams, the Chelsea, had a new manager coming in, Man United's issues, and West Ham were one of those I was getting a bit overexcited about, you know, about whether they could actually do it. And I think it was because of the depth of their squad and the talent in their squad. I mean, they have a real good core in Issa Diop, Declan Rice and Sebastian Haller looked like a good signing. And then they had the flair players, the exciting flair players in Felipe Anderson, Yarmolenko and Pablo Fornals. But it hasn't worked out that way. And I mean, I look at Pellegrini and it just feels he looks like he's one of a few managers in the Premier League who already looks a bit beaten, looks like he's kind of just already waiting for his P45 to come through. And I don't think he doesn't come across as a very, I haven't been in the dressing room with him, I must say, but he doesn't come across as the most inspiring of managers. And they kind of play that way as well. And it's not going to get any easier as well. I think they've got Wolves, Chelsea, obviously, this weekend, and Arsenal after that.
So, as Tom has said there, he was very optimistic about West Ham's chances. So how do we go from, and you weren't the only one, Tom, we should say that. So how do we go from such optimism to this wondering why it's not working for Manuel Pellegrini and West Ham right now? Have you seen anything in the West Ham side to make us question why we were optimistic, but now we're not?
No, I agree that on paper they have got some real talent. But I think there's also I mentioned this the other week, I just feel that there's some sort of, something kind of an atmosphere pervading West Ham, and it comes from the boardroom and the kind of just the leadership. It seems a bit kind of a riddle of shit, really. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, or just a lack of sort of joined up thinking in any processes that go on at West Ham United. I also think that someone like Noble is kind of, he's their talisman, but I think him and Rice has had a bit of a dip in form as well, and they just look like they're getting played around in midfield, and there's going to be several reasons for that. Perhaps the pitch is too stretched and they're kind of a bit isolated, but I also think that they're not the most kind of mobile for a midfield pair, and then they bring in Snodgrass, which felt like a bit of a step back into the past after they've spent so much money on this sort of attacking talent. Mm. But that attacking talent is there, it's just inconsistent. So I think West Ham, they are what they are. I think they're a distinctly average team. And, well, they look at me with that if you want.
I'm not a West Ham fan, but that just went through me.
I think they are, because they're inconsistent in attack, and they don't really have, as Tom alluded to, they don't really have much in the way of an identity. We're going to come on to talk about Wolves and Nuno, and he's, you know, we've spoken about teams like Sheffield United and Bournemouth. You see what the manager is mm-hmm. done to the team. I don't think you can really see that about West Ham. But look, I think there's also, like I say, I think there's a kind of atmosphere at West Ham that's pretty hard to shake. And I think, well, those owners are in charge, it'll probably always be this way.
Well, the West Ham fans certainly aren't the most patient group. They have high expectations at the London Stadium. They let their voices be heard. We've heard it when they showed their dislike of the stadium. They've complained when the owners weren't spending the money. And now their attitude towards Pellegrini, it feels, is getting worse. So is this game this weekend, Tom, a must-win for Manuel Pellegrini?
Well, I think managers always do. Whether you're Jurgen Klopp at the top of the league looking to end a 30-year spell without a league title, or you're at the bottom trying to save your job, managers always talk game by game. Mm-hmm. And that's what Pellegrini's done earlier today. He said, we're just looking at this individual game. But I think maybe a victory against Chelsea would kind of save him from the bullet, but I can't see it making much difference. I think if they did win, you know, it would go in the right direction. But what, they're seven without a win now, and not since September, which was that Man United game, which was when they were fifth in the table at the time. Mm. That was why
got really excited.
I was just about to say, yeah, exactly that. You know, we were, and I think Pellegrini back then was saying about how they were kind of gaining in that consistency. Well, no, they weren't, and I think I think the issue now for them is who would take over.
We did speak about Roberto last week, but you know, he skewed the results as well. I don't think they are as bad as relegation fodder. You know, I think they're a mid-table average Premier League team, and that's the way it is.
So when you said this, Gregor, when everyone was getting excited in September, were you there going, no, this is just average West Ham?
I don't want to blow my trumpet, but I think if you were to listen back, I'd say this is still West Ham, you know. I think we shouldn't get too excited. I say when I'm wrong, but I think, look, West Ham are just a funny club. It's hard to put, that's why I say it comes from the board. I think whenever a club is kind of has a sort of familiar pattern, it often comes from the top. You can change the manager, you can change the players. You've got to look at who's actually picking these picking the managers and who's recruiting the players, and that ultimately comes from the owner of the football club. So I think unless they appoint someone to sort of with a bit of intelligence and a bit of kind of forward thinking, then this is going to be a recurring cycle for West Ham.
Gosh, he's so damning, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Average West Ham and someone with intelligence. So Manuel Pellegrini doesn't have that, is what he's suggesting. Harsh.
See if we can get Pellegrini on the pod next week.
After winning only 4 of their 13 Premier League games this season, Arsenal will likely be weighing up the future of Unai Emery. Reports today are suggesting that they may have now found the successor to him should they decide to sack him. The favourite with the bookmakers to take over from Emery, the Wolves manager, Nuno Espirito Santo. He is doing a fantastic job at Wolves. There is no doubt about it. Do you think that Arsenal could in any way be able to tempt him away from what he's doing at Molineux, Tom?
I don't think so. No, I think he's in a project which is it being extremely effective in how they work. And I was concerned for them at the beginning of the season. I think this is what's been most impressive for me so far is that first Champions League game, Europa League game, how they were going to kind of contend with that. Mm. And they've done it with absolute ease. And I think that's been one of the most impressive things. And he's got an incredible squad which he's assembled there, and we know that it's been kind of fueled by a Portuguese influx, but it's working. It doesn't always mean that it works. It's absolutely working, and you can see why Arsenal would have an interest in him, absolutely. But I can't see him leaving at this stage of the season. I think he'd at least want to see it through this season.
Mm. I mean, like you say, to juggle the Europa League campaign that they are proving to be quite successful in right now, as well as the Premier League, it just shows the tremendous work that Nuno Espirito Santo has put into the squad that he's assembling at Wolves. Gregor?
Absolutely.
I don't know why I paused like that. Sorry.
I think he'd be a good fit for Arsenal, but I don't think he would take it. Mm. I think that says a lot about both clubs. I think it says a lot about where Arsenal are and the sort of toxicity around the place, and it says a lot about how far Wolves have come in the space of a couple of years. Obviously huge investment. It helps to have Jorge Mendes able to kind of work his sort of magic in the transfer market, but it's worked for them, and Wolves fans do not care one jot. They've got they've got some players that they never thought they would see playing for Wolverhampton Wanderers, Moutinho and Neves in particular. I think Nuno is someone who should be spoken about in when sort of big Premier League jobs come up, and I'm sure there might be a time that comes where something would be a bit more appealing to him. But I think Wolves could finish above Arsenal this year. And Wolves have got real sort of aspirations to break into this top six as well, to get into the Champions League and to be a force. And they've got the kind of financial backing to do so. So I think he's happy there, and I'd be very surprised to see him leave for Arsenal.
And that's the thing as well now, what you said at the top about it being a project, because being in the Europa League isn't the target for Wolves. The whole thing is to be in the Champions League, to be a Champions League club. So they're nowhere near. They're not quite there at the end of this project, and you kind of get that around the feel of the rest of the squad as well. You know, the talents of Ruben Neves has been picked up, and he was linked with Liverpool, but it's never gained any real legs, those stories. And you kind of get the feel that that's because they're all invested in what the project is, what they're doing there, what they intend to achieve.
Mm. And it would be a shame for Wolves and Wolves fans, obviously, for Nuno Espirito Santo to leave when there is such a good thing going there at the moment. Why would you want to leave?
Well, I mean, obviously there's several considerations. One being
Cha-ching.
Money. Yes. But I think, like I say, like Tom says, it would take a lot of money, you know, for Wolves. Wolves wouldn't care about how much money they got for him, and they don't care about how much money they get for people like Neves either. They don't need it. And they, you know, there's the basis of kind of a team built for longevity there as well. You know, Jota, Neves, Jimenez, Cody, they're all kind of young, mid to kind of early 20s, potential to develop, and they know they're kind of important cogs in the machine there. Whereas if they were to take a kind of a lucrative move to a team in, you know, a Liverpool or a Manchester City, then it perhaps wouldn't be the case. So I think, you know, they're all in a good place right now. I don't think that's going to be disrupted.
So just to finalise this one, for both of you, he's going nowhere. He's...
So who is it going to be then? That's the thing. That's the million-dollar question. Yeah. I think that's the fascinating thing about this, is that we expected there to be possibly three dismissals this week, and there's been none, because no one knows who to, you know, I'm sure all these clubs are looking around in earnest, thinking, who are we going to, you know, the finger's on the trigger. If they lose a couple more games, then they're going to have to make a change. But I don't think they really know who to go for, and that's quite telling.
That's the issue, isn't it? Trying to find the replacement. And there's talk, you know, of the names always for years, Eddie Howe and the brilliant work he's done down at Bournemouth. And certainly,
but it's a risk. They think, you know, their biggest fear is falling out of the Premier League. So they want to get someone who will sort of make certain their survival. You know, that's when you'll see, that's why you see David Moyes' name sort of doing the rounds again. So I think they should think out of the box and go for someone like
even talking about a club like Arsenal being a risk with someone like Howe.
No, but I mean, I think Arsenal are also thinking that they're perhaps slightly in a different market to the other two clubs.
But that's the thing, isn't it? Someone like Howe, unfortunately for him, isn't a glamorous name for an Arsenal.
No.
Is that his biggest issue for Eddie Howe? Perhaps.
Yeah, and it would take, it's a kind of a leap of faith. It would take some bravery to do that, but I think somebody should do that soon, because I'm not sure what else he can do with Bournemouth, really. And the work he's done there has been nothing short of remarkable. So he's deserving of a Premier League club that he can take on further.
I suppose it's almost the PR element of an appointment, isn't it? Because taking, you know, Tottenham as the biggest example, you replace Pochettino with someone who's the antithesis of what he was. Mm. Yet it's what Mourinho represents. He's a winner. He's a trophy winner. And if Arsenal, you know, if Arsenal had got him, they'd recognise that as well. Someone like Eddie Howe, who hasn't won trophies quite, but done remarkable work, would it get the same reception?
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests, with Tom Roddy and Martin Hardy.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.